and welcome to What's Killing My Kale. This is a podcast from University of Minnesota Extension all about integrated pest management tactics for vegetable and fruit producers. I'm Annie Claude, and I'm an Extension Educator here for fruit and vegetable production.
And I'm Natalie Hoytel, an Extension Educator with the Pesticide Safety and Environmental Education team. Each week, we'll talk with a different farmer or researcher about the specific pest issues they're dealing with and the techniques that they're using to manage those pests.
This is our very first episode, and so we wanted to talk about a pest that everybody is dealing with, weeds.
So this week we're actually going to be starting with Annie, who is our resident fruit and vegetable expert and has a background in integrated weed management. We also drove down to Asika to talk with Charlie Rohr, who's a scientist in vegetable production systems at the Southern Research and Outreach Station.
Right. So when we talk about integrated pest management, we're often referring to insects. And so can you talk a little bit about what integrated weed management looks like?
Yeah, sure. So integrated weed management is just the part of IPM that applies to weeds. And so when we talk about IPM, let's start with the definition of that, I guess. So integrated pest management is all about diversifying the types of tactics that we're using to manage the pests in the field, and we are catering it to the particular pests that are in that operation, that farm. So it's thinking about using the techniques that are most appropriate for the pests at hand, which involves a lot of scouting, involves knowing what pests we're dealing with, and then incorporating mechanical, chemical, cultural, and biological controls all together. So if you apply those concepts to weeds, and we call that integrated weed management, we're still using those four main pillars. Mechanical practices would be like your cultivation or your tillage equipment. Chemical practices would be herbicides. When we talk about cultural practices, we're talking about things like using cover crops and crop rotation in order to get at different pests and break up pest life cycles. So it's just the type of IPM that's applied to weeds.
Okay. So let's talk about those four pillars. You mentioned, started to talk about cultural. Could you maybe give some examples of the other three pillars?
Yeah, sure. So when I talk about mechanical pest management, we're talking about things like using tillage to destruct weed populations, using cultivation to get weeds that are closer to the surface. And flaming is another mechanical weed management technique, fits in that category. Also hand weeding and just removing things with a mower, that also counts as mechanical weed management. So when we send our kids out to the farm and make them weed for us, they're practicing mechanical integrated weed management. So.
Okay. And then chemical, obviously, is the use of herbicides.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what if a farmer doesn't necessarily have all those tools? What if you're an organic farmer and you don't have a lot of options for herbicides? Like, how do you better balance the other three pillars?
Sure. So if you're an organic grower, obviously the options for herbicides are decreased a lot. And so growers who are not using herbicides or using a greatly reduced diversity of herbicides are going to rely more on those other pillars, your cultural, mechanical, and in some cases biological control. And so this just means that if you're not using herbicides, you might end up relying more on tillage or cultivation. And it means that for better or worse, you have a less diversified weed management program.
And what are the consequences of a less diversified weed management program?
Sure. In a heavily cultivation-based system, it means that we're affecting the soil more often. So we're disturbing the soil structure every time that we go in and till or we go in and cultivate. And cultivation and tillage, they greatly affect our weed populations, which is good. They're very destructive on our weed populations, but they also they impact the soil structure. So in a no-till system, we see a lot of life, we see a lot of nematodes, and a lot of organic matter in the soil. And so there are consequences to disturbing that soil. And so if you're using something like a pre-emergent herbicide in your weed management program, that in some cases can actually be used to replace a cultivation pass and decrease the amount of disturbance. Another thing is that when we cultivate and disturb the soil, that not only destructs weeds that are already emerged, but it actually stimulates the germination of weeds that haven't emerged yet too. So that's a really important thing to think about. Like when we cultivate, yes, we're getting rid of weeds, but we're also letting other weeds germinate.
So I had an advisor who did some work with tillage strategies and beneficial insect populations and found that in her studies, when she did fewer cultivations, she had higher insect diversity in her field. But there are obviously some pros and cons then of leaving weeds in the field, because the weeds can support these beneficial insect populations, but then you have to balance that with the density of weeds you want to have on your farm.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that and kind of the pros and cons of how much cultivation you want to do, how many weeds you want to leave in your field?
Yeah. So there are certain weeds that are beneficial to insects. Let's take pollinators, for instance. I mean, there are many flowering dicots out there that pollinators are attracted to, and it's really important that we support our pollinator populations. But I am of the school that we really want to get rid of as many weeds as possible from the field, and that is because in a lot of cases, one weed can carry tens of thousands of seeds. And every time that we leave a weed in the field and we allow it to flower and let it produce seeds, then it's going to return those seeds back into the soil and create a larger weed seed bank for the next year. And so I'll just take pigweed for an example. A lot of the time, pigweed plants can produce up to 500,000 seeds. That's totally reasonable for a pigweed plant. So if we leave that plant in the field, then it's going to drop all of those on the soil. So I like to say try to get rid of as many weeds as possible, or try to buy clean inputs that don't have weed seeds in them from the beginning. And then I definitely support planting pollinator plots in, you know, in the farm as well, but in the actual production area, getting rid of those weeds is pretty important.
Right. Fun fact about pigweed.
Yeah.
Edible.
Yes.
As are many weeds.
Yes.
So if you have a small enough farm, you can see your weeds maybe as a source of leafy greens in your life.
Yep. Lamb's quarter is a pretty good one too. One tip about eating lamb's quarter, it's the younger leaves that are a lot better.
Also Palmer amaranth.
Yeah, Palmer amaranth leaves. Yep. But do not propagate Palmer amaranth.
Right. So we didn't talk about the third pillar of IPM. What is the third pillar?
Which one did we not talk about?
We talked about cultural, mechanical, and chemical.
Yeah. So there's a fourth pillar, biological pest management. And for insect pests, there are often biological tools that we can use. And what biological pest management means is the use of a beneficial insect or a microbe or a nematode to help target specific pests. It's usually species specific. In the case of weeds, in general, there haven't been a whole lot of biological controls identified and commercialized for weed control. So when I talk about planning out an integrated weed management approach, I often don't emphasize the biological aspect of that, just because there's not a lot of research out there yet. And I will, you know, emphasize the mechanical and cultural practices a lot more, mm-hmm. just because we have a lot more techniques available to us for those.
Right. So we're going to dive into mechanical in the next little portion of this episode. But yeah. For now, let's talk a little bit more about the cultural. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about different approaches that people maybe have used with crop rotation and how that can be beneficial for reducing weed populations?
Yeah, so one example, and when we visited Charlie last week in Waseca, he was talking about how he uses this on his farm as well. But one example of this is in a vegetable rotation, a lot of growers find that if they include corn or soybeans as part of their rotation, they are able to introduce different herbicide modes of action to tackle weeds that they are not able to use in their vegetable rotation. So incorporating something like a corner of soybean really increases the amount of weed control potential you can get from your herbicide program, and knocking out weeds in your corn or soybean rotation will then decrease the amount of weed potential that's coming up in the vegetables. So it gives you an opportunity, you know, every few years to really knock down your weed population. Something like sweet corn, there can be more, if you're not interested in incorporating corn or soybean into a rotation, something like sweet corn, there are more herbicide options available for that. Also, just rotating between vegetable groups won't necessarily increase the sheer number of herbicides that you can use every year, but it'll allow you to incorporate different herbicides every year that are rated for those particular vegetable groups.
To avoid resistance building up.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the big principles we use in weed management is rotating and diversifying the herbicide modes of action that we're using. This would be opposed to an approach where we're relying heavily on the same herbicide every year, such as using glyphosate every year, using glufosinate every year in our operations. So I just talked to a grower who was converting his vineyard from using Roundup to using glufosinate, or Rely was the trade name for the product that he was going to use. And the reason he switched over was because Rely was more effective for the weeds on his vineyard. However, what he was doing was just switching from one mode of action to another single mode of action. A more effective approach would to be incorporating or rotating between both glyphosate and glufosinate in order to tackle weeds, because glyphosate is going to be better on some weeds, glufosinate is going to be better on others, and if you're combining modes of action, you're decreasing the potential for your weeds to become resistant, and you're also tackling those weed populations from two directions instead of just one. So that's how I like to talk about IWM a lot, actually, is talking about diversifying the tools that we're using to tackle the weeds on our farm. So it's like you're hitting the weeds with many little hammers, mm-hmm. or you're just hitting them from many directions, and mm-hmm. you know, you can get them when they're down that way.
Yeah. So one consideration, you talked about rotating modes of action, just something to be aware of and careful of is that different pesticides have different pre-harvest intervals and planting intervals. And so you want to make sure that you're not ruling out the planting of a second crop or of a cover crop or even a crop the next year based on the herbicide that you're using. And so just make sure that you're reading the label to use an herbicide that you're not going to end up regretting, basically.
Can you give any examples of that? I mean, I know that some harvest intervals are different, obviously. They have different right. months.
Yeah, so some of the pea and sweet corn herbicides have like a replanting interval where if you were to spray at the end of the summer, you wouldn't be able to plant a certain crop the next year. And so you just want to like really read that label and think long term about what you want to be planting next year so that you don't use something that is then going to harm that crop. So it's partially a food safety issue, like how long can you wait to harvest whatever crop you're growing so that it won't have pesticide residues. And then it's partially an issue of impacting the next crop that comes along. If there's residual activity in the soil, you may end up killing that next crop because it's not selecting that as a crop. It's thinking of it just as a weed.
Yeah, and there's a lot of really good information about yep. those intervals in the Midwest Vegetable Pest Management Guide.
Yes.
Yeah, they have really easy to read tables that talk about what length of interval there is for each product right. and what you can plant after using that product.
Yep. So other than being able to mix up modes of action, what are some of the benefits that rotation gives you in terms of weed management?
Sure. So I definitely don't want to give the impression that the only reason that we rotate vegetables for weed management is because we can rotate modes of action. There are a lot of other reasons why rotating between vegetable groups is really important for weed management. One of those big principles is that different vegetable groups, obviously, as we all know, they have different planting dates, they have different harvest dates, so they have different life cycles. Weeds also have different life cycles. So let's think of a weed like lamb's quarter that comes up in the fairly early spring, you know, May, early June, versus something like pigweed that's going to be coming up starting in about the middle of June through the end of August or September. So just like our vegetables, those weeds have different life cycles. And our planting dates of our vegetable crops do impact weed management as well. Because when we plant a vegetable, we're actually disturbing the soil, and that disturbs the weed populations. If we plant broccoli on, let's say, May 12th every year, that is actually going to promote the survival of the same weed populations every year, because there are going to be certain weed species that are going to do really well in that system. And so it's going to select for those weed populations. So if we rotate between vegetable groups in a field, that's going to cut off those life cycles of those weeds. And so we're not going to see the same weed species dominating from year to year, which is a good thing. So for organic growers, they do not have as many herbicide modes of action available to them. They do have herbicides available to them, such as vinegar and using soaps, and actually hot water can be considered an herbicide as well, anything that's killing the plant. So, but for an organic grower, how would they incorporate those practices into a vegetable rotation, and what does that look like?
Yes, so there are a few options, like you mentioned, vinegar-based, acid-based, soap-based sometimes, and the basic mode of action for all of those is that they degrade the plant cuticle. And basically it can't hold on to water. So it's a really non-selective option. It's going to affect both your crop and the weeds. And a lot of those options are also quite caustic to humans. So that's just kind of a misconception we have about organic products versus conventional, that organic inherently means safe. So if you're using those products, if you're using any herbicide products, just make sure you're taking safety precautions with the vinegar products, wearing gloves. The concentration that's needed to kill a plant is really, really high compared to what you use in your kitchen. Your kitchen vinegar is about 5%. The herbicidal vinegar is about 20%. And so you just have to be really careful about your eyes, about your skin. And then again, they work. They're going to kill the plants, but they're not long-term solutions. They just, they don't have any systemic action. And so you're just going to have to be careful about using other strategies as well.
Yeah, so I would say that that's a really good example of how you would use an integrated weed management approach in an organic system. So you can use vinegar and other products to knock back weeds at some points in the season, but you can't realistically go out into your field every week and apply vinegar.
Right.
And so that's where, if you can use both cultivation, timely cultivation, and vinegar herbicide together, you're going to get better weed control than if you were just applying one of those weed management techniques.
Right, and Charlie also had some interesting insight on those products, so let's cut to Charlie for a minute.
It sounds like you are using a lot of herbicides just because that's the situation that you're in. You're working on research plots. You've got heavy soils where you can't always get in right away to do mechanical cultivation. But a lot of people that we think will be listening to this podcast are organic growers. And so, there are a lot of considerations for them. One having to do with herbicides. I don't know if you have any comments about organic herbicides, if you've tried them. And then, other sort of options for organic growers, solarization, other mechanical techniques.
We've never used solarization. I don't have any experience with that, so I can't really comment on that. We do use plastic mulch quite a bit for, depending on the experiment, we can't grow carrots on plastic mulch really, but brassicas we can. Sometimes we have an open house in September every couple years, and we grow pumpkins on plastic mulch. And that works really well for in-row weed control. I have used some organic herbicides, some burn down herbicides, plant oils and things, and those are contact herbicides, and they work if the coverage is really, really good and if the concentration is good enough and if the weeds are small enough. They can work all right. They are a lot more expensive, which is another consideration. We don't have an unlimited budget, so they're quite a bit more expensive. They can work okay.
Some of those, they're like vinegar-based or other types of acids, citric oils.
Yes.
Have you had any issues when you've experimented with those, with soil acidification?
We haven't looked at that. Our soils have kind of a lot of organic matter in them, and they can buffer a lot of what we might put on them. And the pesticide itself wouldn't get deep enough into the soil to change the pH all that much anyway. So
you don't think that's something people need to worry about much?
Not here, not in our soils. Maybe in a soil that has less buffering capacity, perhaps. But I'm not concerned about that here.
So what would cause a soil to have less buffering capacity?
If it's sandier or has less organic matter, less clay, it would have less buffering capacity.
So in that case, you'd want to be more careful about adding an acidic pesticide or herbicide to your soil.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah.
So all of these strategies that we've been talking about are really great, but how do you think about applying them when you have a diversified farm with, say, 20 different crops that all have just maybe different systems you're growing them in, different scales? How do you think about IPM in those systems?
Sure. Well, one example is some vegetables are grown best on mulch or on raised beds. And so we might think about weed management differently there than we would in an open field setting. Also, the management techniques that we can use for carrots are in some cases a lot different than what we can use for, let's say, broccoli. Because in carrots, we can't use cultivation as liberally. We have to think more about not disturbing those delicate carrot roots. Whereas in broccoli, there are a lot of in-row management techniques for cultivating in that system. So that's one of the challenges is, you know, there are different techniques that we have to think about using on different crops. We just have to think more critically about that. It can also be more time consuming when we're having to use different weed management techniques on different crops. Another challenge is that if you are using herbicides in your integrated weed management program, different herbicides are labeled for different vegetable crops, and that requires a lot of research and making sure that we know that the herbicide we're applying is rated for that vegetable.
Yeah, so Charlie also gave some good examples of what this looks like on the farms that he manages. So
sounds like you work on a lot of different scales. You work on like field scale with sweet corn, you have ginger on a very small scale, working with brassicas. How do your weed management strategies change between those systems? And how do you, basically, what process do you go through to choose which tools, which herbicides, et cetera, you're going to use in each system?
The field scale things, like the peas and sweet corn, we are fortunate that those exist here on our farm in a rotation with field corn and soybeans and small grains sometimes and alfalfa sometimes, because the agronomists who manage those crops try to do a pretty good job of keeping weeds out in the first place. And that's a great way to that's a great way to not have weeds is to start without any weeds. So existing within that rotation is really good, and they do a good job of just not using Roundup over and over again. So, and for peas, so we use a pre-emergent herbicide every year on peas, and then we hand weed as necessary. Once the canopy fills in, if weeds are taller than the peas, they're easy to see because the peas are short, so we can pull them out by hand. And then the peas are ready to harvest, and a lot of weeds don't become an issue in peas because it's such a short season crop, and just we use a good pre-emergent herbicide, and it's not a big issue. With sweet corn, again, that exists in the rotation of peas and of field corn and soybeans. And a lot of times, if we have a weed problem in our sweet corn, it's really localized, and we can just hand weed that. We also use a pre-emergent herbicide in the sweet corn, and that's usually it. Only once can I remember using a post-emergent herbicide on sweet corn. So that's fortunate.
And what about in your smaller systems where you're experimenting with different vegetables or in your brassica plots that maybe look more like sort of a diversified CSA type grower?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Charlie.
For brassicas, we almost always use a pre-emergent herbicide for those too. And that is a lot more hand weeding. The wheel hoe, I've used it a little bit for in brassicas. We can, one way to get rid of small weeds is to bury them or dig them up. And with the wheel hoe, we can do both. We can throw soil up against the plants, the crop. If the crop is big enough and can handle it, we throw the soil up against the brassica, and that buries the weeds that are right next to the plants. And that's pretty effective for a couple weeks at least. And otherwise, it's hand weeding, it's rotations with or fallow. We can leave things fallow for a while and mow and spray fallow areas so that seed populations don't build up. Our soil here is kind of heavy clay, and so if it rains, we can't always get back into the field at the right time for mechanical cultivation. So spot treatments with herbicides is sometimes what we have to do within some of those smaller areas, just because we can't get equipment into the field to work the soil, or we don't want to work wet soil.
All right, so we're coming to the end of this initial discussion on integrated weed management. In part two, we're going to talk more about tools for mechanical control of weeds. But do you have any takeaways from this first part one?
Yeah. So clearly we're just getting our feet wet with integrated weed management here. There's a lot to say on this topic. And so I would just say in general, it's important to use a diversified approach to weed management instead of just relying on one weed management technique, such as just relying on cultivation or just relying on herbicides in our weed management program. We can get a lot better bang for our buck if we're using a diversified approach and get better weed management that way. So I'm really looking forward to the next couple episodes where we're going to interview Charlie again and talk to some other folks about specific weed management tactics.